I'm Josh Porter, and this is the Van City Church Podcast. The following teaching is part four in our series, Nothing Burdensome. A rule of life is one way we embody the lifestyle of Jesus and become more over time people of God's love. But the world of the average modern American pulls at all times toward individualism and consumerism. The kingdom of God accommodates neither. And we are, for the most part anyway, I'm assuming, the vast majority, Americans. All right, hold on a second. Why don't you see where it's going first? You know, Americans, we don't get the world of the first century by default. Why would we? You know, the time and place of Jesus and the first Christians and the early church, that doesn't come to us automatically. And why would we, really? We're over 2,000 years and some change removed on the other side of the world, speaking a different language, different culture, all that. The Jesus movement first began to really proliferate in Jerusalem specifically during a Jewish festival called Shavuot, which is the Feast of Weeks, which occurs 50 days after Passover. It's also called Pentecost because that's the Greek word for 50th. So tons of Jewish pilgrims from elsewhere in the world journeyed to Jerusalem for this occasion. After Jesus, in the story of the Gospels, had come back from the dead and then he ascends into heaven, his disciples went to Jerusalem for Shavuot. While they were there, if you know the story, the Holy Spirit joined them. And it was this incredible scene. Wind rushes in. There's like fire hovering over their heads, the same way that God's presence showed up on Mount Sinai or when it filled the tabernacle. It showed up as like a column of fire, a pillar of fire. But now, God's indwelling presence, the Spirit, isn't a single column of fire filling up one place in time the way it was on Mount Sinai or the way it was in the tabernacle. It's splintered off into multiple flames that appear over the 12 disciples' heads. And now they, people, have become the place where God's presence or his Spirit is. And then lots of more crazy stuff starts happening. The disciples wander out and they start having conversations with all these traveling pilgrims into Jerusalem and telling them the story of Jesus. And somehow they're able to supernaturally like speak different languages that they didn't know before. But these other foreign visitors did know the language so that they could understand them, hear the or tell the story of Jesus. So there's God's presence like fire. There's the new temple of humanity. And now there's miracles. The story of Jesus is going out across language and geographic boundaries and barriers. See, at one point, the tribes of Israel, all the different tribes of Israel were in one place. But then if you know the story of the Old Testament, Israel actually gets overthrown by Babylon. The people of Israel get scattered during this long period of exile from their own land. And now they're all over the place. But here, God is bringing the people back together through miraculous intervention of the Spirit. And for the sake of this new controversial proclamation that Jesus of Nazareth is God's long-promised king. He's the Messiah, and he's actually more than that. He's been executed by the state, but God vindicated him and brought him back to life, revealing that Jesus was more than just an ordinary teacher, more than even just the Messiah. He was and is the Creator God in flesh and blood. And this message is so incredibly powerful, along with the miracle of the Spirit and the languages, all that stuff, that thousands of these traveling pilgrims in Jerusalem for this festival become Christians. And then they begin approaching life and community in a radical new way. They were meeting routinely in homes, around dinner tables. They were, in essence, forming new families. So they'd sell off their stuff and help provide for one another. There were previous political and socioeconomic boundaries between them, and now they're being crossed and destroyed all together as they become this one new family, this one new temple of God's indwelling presence. And they ate together and they prayed daily together. They sat under the teaching of Jesus' apprentices, the 12 apostles, and they're learning everything that Jesus taught, and then they're putting that stuff into practice together. You can read the whole story in the New Testament, a book called Acts, which is a sequel to Luke's biography of Jesus. And from everything we know about this very early and important season of the Christian movement, the church functioned not as a weekly event, not as something to supplement the private lives of individuals who could go from gathering to gathering, looking for people and things to perfectly suit their very specific preferences. The church was necessarily a family. I grew up going to church, like a lot of you, I know. There were some good things about my experience, some not so good things about my experience, but like many of my generation, the not so good things eventually became the reasons that I, in all my infinite adolescent wisdom, decided that church with a capital C was a ripoff. But, you know, time goes by and I was humbled by time and experience, and eventually I found myself not only back in church, but deeply invested in the whole thing. It was a long story, but I got back into it. Now, of course, it wasn't perfect. And I was completely aware of that, but I was also aware that for any and all of its imperfections, the particular church in which my wife Abby and I had found ourselves was actually made up of men and women honestly trying to figure out how to follow Jesus well. And that was incredible to me, and it, honestly, it changed my life. And that enthusiasm for church, this genuine positivity of mine, led to a strange new tension in a lot of my new relationships over time. See, ordinarily, I am pessimistic by nature, which is a bad thing, not a good thing, to be clear. And God has been working on me in that regard over the years. But here I was, the positive person. Again, not blind, unthinking idealism as if the church could do no wrong. You know, of course, church is a family. Of course, we can be honest with each other, which includes being candid about where we're at, about our struggles and doubts, even the way that we hurt each other. We should be able to talk vulnerably with one another. But that kind of necessary transparency wasn't the thing creating the tension. It was a spirit of Yelp reviews. You know, it was the constant objectification of the church and its leaders, as if the church were a taco stand or a coffee shop. You know, this ever-present litany of nitpicks from those who would cross the church's threshold here and there, not to give, but to take, and who reserved the right to let others know if the goods and services provided were satisfactory or decidedly less so. I don't like the lighting. I didn't like the songs this week. That sermon wasn't the best. They serve grapes now. How much do grapes cost? Are grapes the best use of church budget? Who doesn't like grapes? And we decided, you know, like people would come up to me or in conversation or in community, oh, we decided not to tithe because we didn't like the way they broached this controversial issue. Or we decided to skip this week. We wanted to watch TV, or we were tired, or I'm not joining a small group. I was in one at another church and I didn't like that one. So until someone can convince me that these are better, I will wait. Thank you very much. Now, don't get me wrong. Of course, all of us in the process of spiritual formation do some awkward learning and trial and error stuff in community with other people. That's inevitable. I know I did, but this and am doing. But this sense of arm's length entitlement is something else entirely. I don't get offended by a lot of stuff, quite frankly, but this kind of thing drove me crazy because I would think some of us, warts and all, are trying to do this. We're trying to work out our salvation with fear and trembling and navigate the complexities of sharing life for the sake of Jesus, to have all of that subjected to such cold scrutiny, to me, was kind of a tragedy. And I would tell that these people that I knew, when they would say these things, well, yeah, it's a mess, but come join us in the mess. Trust me, it's good. It's good in the mess. It's flawed and it's complicated, but it's good. And people were often annoyed by Abby and me because of our unwillingness to tear the church apart, because we'd have to admit we just don't agree. We'd get into these sessions with people where there was a long list of everything that was wrong about this particular church. We're like, oh, we just don't feel that way. Yes, we know it's not perfect, but we don't feel that way. Yeah, we know the church is people and people are broken. Yeah, but we also know that we're not so great. And how on earth can we expect anyone to carry all the complexities of who we are if we are subjected to that same ruthless dissection? In other words, is your life under the same merciless microscope, or is it just the church as an institution? And, you know, in this particular church, the preacher had become my friend, and I'd sit in small groups listening to people just shred the guy, and I'd ruin everyone's fun by saying, well, look, if you really have such a problem with the guy, why don't you go tell him? No one wants to hear that. You know, we like to eviscerate people behind closed doors. Thank you very much. Why has this guy got to speak up and ruin all the fun? Or, you know, we like the idea of leaving people a bad review, so to speak, anonymously. And why not? In America, the land of individualism, a kind of entitled consumer anonymity is honestly the air that we breathe. It is the culture around us. We all have this kind of spirit somewhere in us, myself absolutely included, because it's the way that we're raised. It's the environment in which we live. If we go out somewhere and we have a pretty decent experience, most of us don't usually think to tell anyone about it. But if we have a bad one, we want someone or many people to know all about it. Here's an embarrassing story. Last year, my family had planned this cabin getaway, and we were leaving on a Monday morning, but then on Sunday night, I drove through our garage door. I drove the heck out of that thing. Like, I'm still honestly not sure what happened. I've never been in a car wreck before, like a fender bender once, but this was way worse. Like, I plowed through that thing. And the worst part was, I wasn't even arriving. I was leaving to go to church. So that was weird. And it happened in a moment, too. I wasn't sure what happened, but there I was in the collapsed garage. And then Abby just opened the front door. She was not pleased. Neither was I. But I was late. I was late for work, and I was playing drums, so I sort of just backed out and left the whole thing in ruins. And then I had my laptop in there with me during rehearsal, and I was Googling contractors to find someone to put the garage back together. I found some dude to come install a new garage door the next morning, which was, of course, very expensive, but, you know, what can you do? We ended up making it to this cabin, if not a little late. All's well that ends well, I guess. But then that night, that's the embarrassing part. That night, at the cabin, the contractor guy called me up. I thought something had gone wrong, so, you know, I answer even though I'm supposed to be on vacation. And he's like, hey, is everything good? Yep, we're all settled up. Great. He's like, and now can I have a tip? And I said, a tip? I said, he said, yeah, a tip. I'm just going to run your card. Let's call it 30 or 40%. Now, yeah, that's a big old tip. Now, I've never contracted a dude to fix my garage door. I don't know the etiquette, and the whole conversation was weird, and we sort of expended a significant amount of our finances to even fix this door. So I'm saying all this over the phone to some dude who's becoming increasingly frustrated with my unwillingness to just hand over this 40% tip that I didn't have. And he starts going, are you kidding me, man? Are you serious? You know, like that. Not my favorite phone call. Then I was all sped up afterward, you know. I was like doing little laps in that cabin. I surprised myself. I don't really... this is honest, I don't usually or ever complain about anything in consumer situations because I don't really care all that much. Like, food's wrong, whatever, you know, I just kind of shrug it off. But my first thought was, I'm about to get on the internet and leave this guy a terrible review, the worst review ever. I didn't, just to be clear, I came to my senses. I didn't leave a review at all. But before the call, after this guy had showed up the next morning, hours really, did a speedy repair, did a pretty good job, I didn't really think to leave a review or tell anyone either way. I was just like, great. And then I went about my business. But now that I was ticked, I wanted someone to know about it, you know, because I'm a consumer. I'm the byproduct of a lifestyle obsession. All my life, I've been taught, directly or indirectly, a tit-for-tat code of consumer ethics handed down to me by a long line of Americans before me. Work, earn your keep, and when you earn it, it's yours. The world can and should function along certain lines of privacy and decency, and you're responsible for you. But then there's this Jesus guy. And when Jesus talked about God, he used the word Father. And when he talked about anyone who does the will of the Father, he said that those people are his brothers and sisters and mother. Which is actually incredible. See, the world in which Jesus lived was something called a collectivist society. It's what sociologists call strong group identity. Here's a definition from Bruce Molina. He says, in a strong group society, the person perceives himself or herself to be a member of a group and responsible to the group for his or her actions, destiny, career development, and life in general. The individual person is embedded in the group and is free to do what he or she feels right and necessary only if in accord with the group norms and only if the action is in the group's best interest. The group has priority over the individual member. Now, this kind of culture is not a thing of the distant past. It's still well represented throughout the world in Asia, South America, the Arabic world, Africa, really most places beyond Western society. But in the Western world, what we have what sociologists call individualist cultures or weak group identities. It's the other way around. The individual takes priority over the group. The desires and happiness of the individual always take precedence over the group. And we, as a general rule, act in our own best interest or in the best interest of kind of our private family unit. So for many, if not most of us, the idea of a strong group identity sounds at best really weird and at worst absurd or even oppressive. And the dichotomy between the two kind of widens as Western culture continues to evolve. In the West, we've seen this consistent rise in something called tribalism, which is less of a community of unified belief and more so an angry mob of against. And this is made manifest in partisan political warfare, outrage culture, the word police, and intense us versus them boundaries with an emphasis on the idea of the right side of history, often defined by kind of a tiny but very vocal internet subculture. Now, that's not the same thing as a collectivist culture. That's not the same thing as a strong group identity. In collectivist cultures, there are typically clearly defined gender roles and paradigms, ongoing interfamily roles, honor and shame. There's even the pursuit of restoring honor to the one who has been shamed, which is completely unlike our American idea of cancel culture. These ideas seem foreign, even alien, to the average modern American. In the world Jesus knew, your primary concern was for the family, not the individual in the family per se. In Jesus' world, in his culture, your identity was inseparable from your immediate family. Now, part and parcel of first century Jewish life was the idea of family defined by the father's bloodline, not by marriages. So you may have noticed in the Bible how often characters are referred to as something like Simon, son of Jonah. This is called a patrilineal culture, so there's no surnames, you're just son of. My kid would be Beck, son of Joshua. In a patrilineal culture, your spouse was not a part of your family proper. The bride would join the tribe of the groom. And marriage typically wasn't about romantic love connections, at least not primarily. It was about family arrangements for the good of the tribe. So ordinarily, siblings in the ancient world were thought to have the primary bond and the most important life relationship. And in the ancient world, it was a relationship based on the good of the family at personal expense and localized within that tribe and bloodline. But then Jesus steps into that conversation and that culture, and he refers to his community, meaning like his students, apprentices, his followers, and his friends. Most of them are well outside of his tribe, as the culture defined it. He refers to them as brothers and sisters. That is his primary bond and the most important relationship, blood or not, tribe or not. That was a radical idea. And it wasn't because Jesus expected his community to function like an idea, or like a family. That's not what made it radical. That's actually a very old idea. Really, from page one of the Bible, we're presented with a deeply relational portrait of God. And on page one, God announces, "Let us make people in our image and likeness." And scholars have debated, you know, is the us the divine council of spiritual beings? Is the us God talking to the other members of the Trinity? But really, either way, it reveals something important about God. By default, God is relational, and what he does is relational. Even the most important things, Gary Brashears over at Western Seminary says, God is a family who makes families. Meaning, we exist, that we exist at all, is an outworking of God's overflowing relational love, and we were created for relational love. So the idea that the people of God were, at least in some sense, a family, that's not really the radical aspect of Jesus' teaching. What's radical is that Jesus doesn't define his family by blood, but by, in his language, whoever does God's will. Which is incredible given how intensely defined the lines between Jews and Gentiles have been drawn in Jesus' culture. But Jesus is here saying that the true family of God is open to Jews, to Gentiles, to anyone who does God's will, which means inevitably the family of God is multi-ethnic, they come from all over the world. This is one idea among several that eventually got Jesus killed. In fact, Later in that same story, Jesus goes ham on some corruption that he finds in the temple. And in his anger, he quotes from the prophet Jeremiah saying, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations." Ruh-roh, you can't go around saying stuff like that to the religious leaders. This was Jesus condemning the temple establishment that had shut all non-Jewish peoples out of God's presence. That kind of talk was also one of the things that got Jesus killed. But it wasn't just Jesus' ideas of a multi-ethnic family, not defined by blood, that's so radical. There was another, even more subversive dimension to this teaching. So stay with me, we're almost to the point. Not only does Jesus extend family beyond the father's bloodline, that's radical, he elevates that family to the place of primary importance. Remember, Jesus said that whoever does God's will was his mother and brother and sister. That was a scandalous thing to suggest. That is the primary relationship, the primary bond in a person's life in Jesus' culture. Jesus was the oldest living male in his family line, so he was responsible for the leadership in his family. But here, he's saying that his family is part of a much bigger family and that that family is most important. Jesus does not critique or reinvent the collectivist or strong group approach to community. He simply teaches that his community must become the primary community, the primary family for those that follow him. In other words, Jesus doesn't present any model for individualism the way that we know it, in which, the individual takes priority over the group and the desires and happiness of the one always take precedence over the many. Now, I don't mean that Jesus doesn't care about you, the individual, or that the individual within the group is meaningless, or that you should have no autonomy at all, or anything like that. I just mean that Jesus understands God's people as a family, and that they carry out all of life together as a family. And that is wildly at odds with the American sensibility. Here, I'll show you. You're not going to like this. Let me read that earlier quote again, but I'm going to replace the term group with the term church and kind of take note of how this makes you feel as I read it. In the church, the person perceives himself or herself to be a member of the church and responsible to the church for his or her actions, destiny, career, development, and life in general. The individual person is embedded in the church and is free to do what he or she feels right and necessary only if in accord with the church norms and only if the action is in the church's best interest. The church has priority over the individual member. That makes us feel weirded out and itchy or allergic. And believe me, I totally get it. Part of my personality and wiring, I've told you guys this a million times, includes kind of this intense aversion to anything that I perceive to be outside control. I don't like being told what to do. I hate homogeny. I hate groupthink to a terrible fault of my own. But Jesus' invitation isn't to control. His invitation is to self-sacrificial love for one another, which looks like anything but control. And Jesus' invitation isn't to homogeneity. God has uniquely crafted you and me, everyone in here, to make unique contributions in the family and kingdom of God. You're not supposed to disappear as drones into a herd. And Jesus' invitation certainly isn't to groupthink. I mean, read the Bible. There's a rich, clear, well-represented tradition of diverse thought, wrestling with doubts, working things out with differences intact, all in community as a family. But even if you have all that nuance, Jesus' invitation is to value others above yourselves. In fact, Paul will go on to say that explicitly several times throughout his letters in the New Testament. And that much is exceedingly clear, and not just the valuing of worthy individuals as above yourself, but the entire community and those beyond your community, because that's what Jesus did. As Taylor read at the outset of the teaching, there's a unique concern within that idea to do good to all people for the family of God, especially, she read, those who belong to the family of believers. Now, here's where I'm going with all that. Throughout this series, all about a rule of life, living into a set of spiritual rhythms uniquely defined by your season of life and your stage of apprenticeship, I've said that our hope is to invite all of you to write, rewrite, revisit, and implement your own rule of life, And as a part of your own unique personal rule, they'll look different from person to person, we are inviting you, you don't have to, but we are inviting you to consider taking on the church-wide rule of life as well, which I've said many times is come to church on Sunday, be in a Van City community, serve, and give. Now notice, all of those things, in a certain sense, are about you and your own spiritual formation. But all of these things are also outward focused simultaneously. They're about everyone in this room come to church on Sunday. They're about a group of people around a dinner table with whom you share life, be in a Van City community. They're about pitching in to facilitate church happening in the first place, serving, time, energy, gifts, and they're about giving through finances. And this is absolutely crucial in understanding the idea of a rule of life. Remember the origins. Jesus lived into spiritual rhythms based on his calling, his vocation, his roles, his mission, in and to the world, not to serve some self-helpy purpose. Of course, spiritual formation makes you into a quote-unquote better person, but the end goal is to be with God, not self-improvement. Jesus embraced a life of spiritual rhythms to be who God called him to be for the sake of other people and the world. The early church, when they wrote about consistent life rhythms of spiritual disciplines, wrote about them in the context of community, meaning they were doing all this stuff together. And then when Saint Benedict coined the term rule of life around the 6th century, it wasn't for him as an individual, it was for all the monks sharing life together in his monastery. So your rule of life should not be focused entirely on you getting your peaceful time of silence and prayer for your own sanity and formation alone. Those things are wonderful, they're important, you should prioritize them, but that's not in and of it the entire rule. All of it, from silence and solitude, fasting, community, whatever populates your rule, all of it is about you becoming more and more a person of God's love as defined by Jesus and the scriptures. Now, recently, Taylor Long, who was just up here a minute ago, our director of kids, she said something really profound that highlights this idea of caring for the church beautifully and in a way that was terribly convicting. We were in a meeting, and we were talking about our desperate need for more people to serve with Van City Kids, and I looked up some stats for you guys that kind of blew my mind. One survey I consulted this week reported that, in the U.S. anyway, the national average is that kids, which means birth to fifth grade, that they represent somewhere between 19 and 21% of total attendance in the average church on Sunday. So meaning, if you count every single person in this building right now, the average number of them, 19% should be kids. 23% is considered above average in America. And a church with 32% kids makes up only 10% of the entire American church. 32% kids means that you are in the absolute upper echelon of kid-crowded churches, okay? Ours has almost 39%. That's true. I'm not kidding. 39% of people in here on a Sunday night are kids. Dude, are we the most kid-heavy church in America? And listen, that rules. That's awesome. And here, I'll show you. Watch this. Parents in the room, how many of you, by a show of hands, want your kids growing up around tons of other kids in Christian families, all of us figuring out how to follow Jesus together, right? Yeah, 100% of parents, absolutely, myself, yeah, included. It rules, but watch this. Those of you who serve with Van City Kids, meaning parents as well, and I swear you won't get in any trouble for this, how many of you would admit that leading kids' church at what might be the most kid-heavy church in America is often very challenging? It can be challenging. Yeah, of course it is. So we were in a staff meeting talking about all this, and Taylor, who does such an incredible job for our church, she's constantly trying to solve never-ending lists of issues. Where do we put all these kids physically? How do we get more people to help? Should we divide the classrooms? How do we get more people to help? Should we use the portal? How do we get more people to help? How do we get more people to help? And she said, I think one of the most important things for us to do is to teach our church to unlearn the lie that says your kids are your problem. Now, don't get me wrong. If you're a parent, of course, your children are first and foremost your responsibility. It's incumbent on you to lead your kids in the way of Jesus by your words, what you teach them, bringing them to church, your lifestyle, all of that. But, and please listen to me, the deeply American idea that we are islands of responsibility unto ourselves, it's completely contrary to the way of the kingdom of God. I badly want, and I pray for this every single day, that all three of my kids would have you guys speaking into their lives on a regular basis, knowing them, caring for them. My kids come home talking about you guys that lead their classes. They love you guys, and quite frankly, it gets me all sentimental and choked up. You know, Beck will come home, and he'll be like, man, I like Andy. Andy's cool. And I'm like, well, I'm cool, you know. But he's like, I like Leslie, I like Hannah and Spencer, I like when they're my teachers, or Isla says, Stacy was my teacher, she's so nice, or they're like, we like Dave Zerotti, we like Kevin Erickson. I'm like, well, who doesn't? Those guys are fun. My youngest son, if you guys don't know this guy, he was such a butthead to anyone, not me or Abby, for like the first year and a half of his life. Still a butthead now, but he's becoming little by little less buttheadish. And honestly, you know, a lot of that's just kids getting older and blah, 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 but I really think a ton of it has to do, at least in this environment, with people every single Sunday gently approaching him, smiling and saying, hey, Arlo, are you going to scream in my face tonight? You going to say hey to me this time? And, you know, the scream sort of went away, and now he smiles out of the corner of his face. And I think the reason that people approach this guy and say hey to him is not just because, oh, he's cute or whatever. It's because he's part of our family. Even now, 2 years old, this guy, he is as much a part of Van City as me or Cam or Levi or Taylor or anyone else in the room, and so are your kids. Now, don't check out. Please stay with me on this. I'm not saying any of that as yet another big pitch for why you should serve with Van City Kids. You guys already know all that stuff. I'm saying this because it's the easiest example of what it means to serve this particular family and what it means to be a family at all. Because serving with Van City Kids isn't always glamorous. It can be wild. You saw the show of hands. It's more of a time ask than, you know, say, making coffee before the gathering. It takes you out of the gathering once a month. But 39% of our whole church is downstairs right now. Just the kids, not even counting the people who are serving. That's our family. Our family is all of our responsibility. The same is true of something like giving finances. At Van City, we've tried very hard across these almost 8 years now to really be above reproach with our finances. We have a team of leaders who aren't on staff, who make decisions about final budget numbers. They're the ones who decide salaries. So, you know, Cam and I can't sit around being like, you should get this much. And he's like, oh, really? I think you should get this much. Doesn't work like that. We don't have any say. We consult other churches. We consult other more experienced leaders about our money. We show them our entire budget sheets. What should we do? What do you think? Give us advice. How to steward it best. And if I may say so, we're pretty frugal. In fact, the people on these teams go like, well, you're not spending the money that you set aside on these things. Well, oh, we're trying to not spend anything. See what happens. Now, I'm not saying that it's impossible that we've ever made any imperfect decision. Of course it could be possible. I'm sure it's happened. I just mean that I can say with integrity that we're really, really trying to erect multiple measures to protect us from financial irresponsibility. And obviously it requires finances to make all this happen, not just the bells and whistles like coffee and guitar cables, but being able to pay our staff so they don't have to get other jobs to provide for their families, thus making themselves unavailable to work here at Van City, or rent that we're in this building at all, or kids' curriculum that the kids have something to do downstairs, the microphone I'm using so you can hear me, grape juice, all of that stuff. The finances necessary to make all this happen should not be the sole responsibility of a few well-off and generous people and charitable donors from outside the state. And look, I get it. We've all seen or heard about weird, bad stuff when it comes to churches and money. But if I may, I really don't believe that that entitles us to extreme prejudice around giving. It just doesn't. I've talked to other people over the years from various churches who withhold finances for all kinds of reasons. They didn't agree with a certain expenditure, or they want detailed access to all the books before they give any money, or they just felt like it's just not how they were called to serve the church by giving finances. Now, last year, in an incredible freak accident, Both my kids broke their wrists, same wrists, and like a couple weeks apart. Now imagine if Abby told me one evening, so we have to pay these doctor bills, by the way, for these kids having to go to the hospital and get casts on their wrists. And I said, well, you know, I don't really feel like I want to pitch in for that. You know, I don't like the way that you spent money on a new oven mitt. I felt like the old one was fine. That was unnecessary to me. And frankly, I've been hurt by hospitals in the past. She would rightly rebut, are you insane? Have you lost your God-given mind? This is our family. These are our kids. They're our responsibility. Now, again, I don't want anyone to misconstrue what I'm saying. I'm not saying that unless you serve with kids and unless you, you know, unwaveringly give us heaps of unquestioning cash, you're not really part of this family at all. But what I do want to say very clearly is that as the family of God, we have to work very hard to completely rewire our assumptions about what is and isn't ours and what it means for the church to be a family. And if you're new to Van City or you're new to church in general, welcome. This isn't for you. We're not usually this hardcore. But if you call Van City home, this is your family as much as it is mine. And we may have unique roles to fulfill within the family dynamic, as is the case with any family, but it's your responsibility to care for the family, and it's mine, and it's Cam's, and it's everyone in your community, all that. I can't stress this enough. So many of us who have traveled in church circles have consciously or subconsciously bought into the idea that church is a supplemental event hosted and carried out by people paid to do so, and that we come and go at our leisure, when we feel like it, if we feel like it, to consume and critique like any other goods and services. We'll support it if it meets our personal criteria, and we'll support it according to our terms. That's not a family. That's a restaurant. That's a dang hotel. The church is not a public service provided for consumers. It isn't. It is not a commodity. And here's what all that has to do with the idea of a rule of life. The idea of a set of specific life rhythms and spiritual disciplines by which you organize your days and weeks and months and years. The idea, ultimately, is not even you. It's you and God. And when you draw near to God, God draws you beyond the narrow confines of individualism. The more that you know Jesus, the more that Jesus will bring you out of your interior world for the sake of others. Now, for years, decades, the post-Christian world of America has been desperate to reinvent Christianity as a spirituality befitting the individualist, because we are, in America, individualists, and we'd very much like the two things to line up. The idea that you don't need church, and you can have your own spiritual experience. You certainly don't need authority, leaders looking after you. That's oppression. You don't need the historic reading of the scriptures handed down by generations of saints and sages and experts across the world throughout centuries, because we have TikTok videos. And you have your own subjective sensibility. Just recently, someone sent me what I assumed was a TikTok video based on the shape of it. And it was a young woman who was in some 50 seconds or whatever. She made some very serious claims about certain things that were added into the Bible at a certain point in time and how the Bible doesn't actually say anything about this or that controversial issue. And she was saying all this stuff with conviction. She gave dates, the whole thing. And none of it was accurate, not even close. I don't even mean, oh, look at me, I got masters in Bible, I know. No, I mean, like, just a basic look it up would tell you none of that stuff is true. But through the dismal lens with which I tend to view humanity, I assume probably a lot of people see this thing, or just part of it, because, you know, 50 seconds, that's a lot to ask the modern attention span. And they figure, well, there you go. That's that. I had no idea. Church made this up. This stuff's not even in the Bible. You know, Bible, unnecessary. Church, forget it. Structure, discipline, that's just another way of saying oppression. And then faith becomes fluid, and then faded, and then dead. And in my own personal experience, 100% of the time, it leads to no faith at all. Because it's essentially the pursuit of having a family with no other family members. No accountability, no shared life. It just can't possibly be done. I want a family, but just me. Good luck. Let me know how it goes. Growing up, I learned all the basic stuff about grace and God's love, and I believed it, but I couldn't shake the performative suspicion, you know, that the end goal of all this grace and love is to get me to behave a certain way. And then we talk about spiritual disciplines, about a rule of life. And it's really hard not to, at least accidentally or subconsciously, pick up that old playbook. Okay, right, being a good Christian means I pray every day, I read my Bible every day, put that in my rule of life. Got it. And obviously we believe in spiritual disciplines or we wouldn't be knee-deep in this series right now, but we are not responding to God's grace with willpower and obedience. You understand what I mean? As if the idea were, look, you know, Jesus died for you. The least you could do is a handful of spiritual chores, okay? I was talking to my spiritual director about all this a couple weeks ago, and he interrupted me with just the most simple analogy. It's almost embarrassing. And he's like, why do you make time to hang out with your wife? Which, you know, already I'm like, all right, I get where this is going, you know? And I was like, well, you know, I love her, and it's not just in the sentimental, I have positive feelings about her kind of way. Like, she's actually my best friend. I sincerely enjoy her company. It's fun. I want to be with her. I like it, blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, but don't you've told me about your rule of life. Don't you schedule date nights? And don't you plan vacations? Or don't you even set aside unique, specific hours on the calendar to talk or watch movies or for sex or whatever it might be? And that kind of sounds like chores. That sounds inorganic. That sounds like obligatory gestures that you have to do just because you're married, and that's good married behavior. That's performative. I said, well, obviously, of course not. We make that space because we want to do it. We love each other. We're responding to and acting on our love. It's not an obligation. It's not a willful gesture of obedience only. And we know that it won't happen if we don't do it. So we got it. And he's like, well, there you go. I'm like, I got it. I heard it, you know, the first time. Now, if you think of the spiritual disciplines and a rule of life as an imposed system of chores, of course you'll think of church, the same kind of Western suspicion that constantly clouds our perspective about anything. What's in it for me? What about what I want? They need to show me they deserve my time or my money. This leader needs to acknowledge me this certain way. I expect to be acknowledged. But then we become the parent holding their kid's hospital bill and saying, I don't see what this has to do with me. This, all this is ours to steward together. And yes, it's Jesus's church, and all of us have different roles to play within the church, and yes, the leaders are uniquely responsible, all that stuff. But God has given all of us this call, this church home, a responsibility to care for it. All of us are that parent with that hospital bill. The question is, in what ways can you care for the family in this season of your life and this stage of your apprenticeship? Now, you'll notice the church-wide rule of life says, go to church on Sunday, be in a Van City community, serve, and give. It doesn't say, specifically with an asterisk, come to church on Sunday, be in a Van City community, serve by making community before the gathering, or communion before the gathering. Because some of you, you know, work late. You can't show up early to make communion. It doesn't say, serve by playing guitar in the band, because some of you don't play guitar. And it says give, but it doesn't say give $1,000 every month, because some of you don't have $1,000 to give every month. Come to church on Sunday, be in a Van City community, serve, and give. The way that you uniquely qualify each of those things, or at least the second or the third and fourth things, will depend on your season of life and your stage of apprenticeships. Now, my kids are 10, 7, and 2. There's very little that Arlo, who's 2, can do in terms of chores and pitching it at this point. He's in a season where the rest of us care for him, and you'll be in that season at some point in your life, young or old. If you haven't been there already, you'll be there again. Abby and I have more to give, more responsibility, and more ability to carry those responsibilities out. But Beck, who's 10, he has chores. And Isla, she can help too. It's their family too, not just Abby's and mine. Now please, please do not think of all this as some organization in want of volunteers. It's not. We are a family simply inviting each other to behave as a family. When a family is healthy, everyone pitches in. as best as they can, as much as they can, they pitch in. Of course, we need finances to survive, and of course, we can't even have the Sunday gathering without dozens of people serving. They are doing it right now throughout the evening, dozens of people. It's just not that simple. It's about ordering your life in such a way that it demonstrates the love of God through the love of his family. Remember that line from Galatians, especially for those who belong to the family of believers. So as you write and rewrite and revise and implement your rule of life, and as you consider our invitation to a church-wide rule of life, my humble request is that you would think about, pray about, discuss with your spouse or your community, how can I serve alongside my family, Van City Church, in this season of my life? What is the amount of finances that God is inviting me to contribute for the sake of my family in this season? There are crucial ways to serve the church that range from like a few extra minutes of setup before the gathering on Sunday, all the way to the dedication necessary to care for 39% of the church by serving once a month in Van City Kids, with lots of different kinds of ways to serve in between those two extremes. So talk about it. Ask God, how can I continue to rewire my soul so that I come to the family of God not wanting just to be served, but to serve? How can I reorient my focus on others so that I'm less preoccupied with myself and more inclined to give myself away? I honestly believe that my love for the church, which grew out of a season of feeling terribly at odds with the church, that love, it grew and flourished in that important season of my life some 14 years ago now. It was formed by sermons, of course. It was formed during worship and being encouraged by people, relationships, all that for sure. But maybe most of it was formed vacuuming the floor when everyone left with a handful of other people. Not in any kind of self-righteous way, like, I can't believe I stayed after and vacuumed the floors. Actually, a lot of fun, and anyone in the world could have done it. Got to wear these Ghostbuster packs. It was a thing. But there was this sense, vacuuming those floors with a handful of other people, that like, oh, I'm part of this. This is my family too. I'm caring for this in the way that I can right now. I don't know what else to do. I don't know what else to offer, but I can do this, and it's my family too. Someone has to teach those 70 kids downstairs what it means to defy individualism, and we do that by demonstrating life in family. And we need that for one another and from one another, a sense that all this is being cared for by all of us. For any and all of the ways that we can and will fumble and fall and get it wrong, that we are trying to follow the Master, and we are trying to do it together. So let's pray and ask God's Spirit to lead us and guide us into deeper obedience as a family.
Thanks for listening to Van City. You can connect with us and find more teachings and available resources at www.vancity.church. You can support Van City financially at vancity.church/give.